They had it on the front page that these two satellites had been detected. Now, behind the scenes, which a lot of people didn't know, was the government had, number one, the reported encounter with Eisenhower with the aliens at Muroc in February. So if they're detecting these objects, and if there's an encounter between Eisenhower and the aliens, if that story is true, and it is one of the main stories that's told, then there is not only are they tracking these two objects going around the Earth, but there's communication, and they've actually set up a meeting with Eisenhower. And the Americans had not just that one encounter, they had two encounters that both the FBI, the CIA, and the Navy were involved in, and the Air Force were involved in two other encounters that are very rarely mentioned. And in my article, I tie these in. And one is a woman in Elliott, Maine, who lived just down the street from Betty Hill, near the nuclear submarine base there. And this woman in... her encounters started in the fall of 1953 as well, on Halloween evening was when hers started. In May of 1954, she goes to a member of the board at NICAP, who was Admiral Knowles, and he lives next door to her, or a couple doors down, and she mentions to Admiral Knowles that she's in contact with some aliens. And she's getting these messages in her ear. She's sort of like, she's sort of doing like the automatic writing. She's getting these messages. Knowles goes there. Kehoe knows about this. Knowles contacts the Navy, Navy Intelligence. Navy Intelligence gets interested in this woman because she's a woman who has almost no education whatsoever. And she's able to answer scientific, technical questions. So the CIA gets involved. Navy Intelligence gets involved. They're all watching this woman. And what she's saying is, there's two huge spacecrafts orbiting the Earth at the same time as this story is breaking about the Air Force tracking these two objects. And she says these two are flying around the Earth, and one is commanded by AFA. The alien that's running the one spaceship is AFA. The other one is PONAR. So she's talking about this. And Wilbur Smith is also in Canada, knows the same story. He's a contactee. He's dealing with this Mrs. Swan. This is 1954. And then the story that ties in there is that he's making contact, and he says to Mrs. Swan, just after Eisenhower's encounter, he says, well, I'd like you to get AFA to fly over Canada. And what Wilbur Smith had is he had a flying saucer observatory outside the Canadian capital, and in there he had a bunch of stuff. He was detecting noise, gravity, five different things, and he was setting up this thing to detect if a flying saucer coming over the Canadian capital. So he talks to this Mrs. Swan, 54. He says, I need you to get AFA to fly over. I want to make a radio communication with him. And in August of 1954, just before Aviation runs the story, Wilbur Smith goes and says that on August the 8th, 1954, they detected a flying saucer coming over the Flying Saucer Observatory, and this was a week after he was in contact with Mrs. Swan. They were supposed to fly it over on the Saturday, August the 1st. The actual flyover took place on the 8th. This was AFA supposed to be flying over. So suddenly, Wilbur Smith goes public in Canada, and he's speaking on behalf of the Canadian government. He's running the Canadian government UFO program. He goes public and says, we've just detected, if the machinery is working, we've just detected the first flying saucer over Canada, over the Canadian capital. And, of course, 2 days later, the Canadian government is now in a box. 2 days later, they shut down the Canadian government program on flying saucers. They say there's no evidence. The regular story is no evidence. Wilbur Smith can continue to do research. And so you have a situation where these two satellites that everybody's watching, Smith says he's in contact with them, and he's got one of the commanders to fly over the Flying Saucer Observatory. And then the other incident that occurs is in 1954, and this has been confirmed by Paul Hellyer. When Paul Hellyer was the defense minister in Canada in 1967, he made a speech at a centennial project. It was like a community had built one of these UFO landing bases as a centennial project, a little sort of tourist attraction thing in Alberta, outside of St. Paul, Alberta. Hellyer goes there to open this speech, open this UFO landing base in 1967. And during that speech, he says, in 1954, the Canadian government opened up a base for UFOs to land, and the base was Suffield. It's Canadian, the Canadian equivalent to Area 51. It's an army base. It has restricted; you can't fly over it. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And Hellyer says that the Canadian government's had opened up this base, and he's the defense minister at the time. This is an official speech he's making, and he says nothing ever landed, therefore UFOs don't exist. 1970s, I and another researcher in Canada start going after Hellyer, and we said, well, this is all fine and good, but how do the UFOs know where to land? You've opened the base for the UFOs to land. How do you know? So, of course, because I knew this whole thing about Mrs. Swan being in contact with this alien, these two crafts going around the Earth, and I knew that Smith was in contact with her, and I knew that Smith had had the thing fly over the observatory in Washington or in Ottawa, 1977, I go to Wilbur Smith's wife. Wilbur Smith had died in 62, so I went to his widow, and I said, I showed her the article of Hellyer talking about 1954, this base being opened for UFOs to land. I showed her the article. I said, Mrs. Smith, I said, was Wilbur involved? She read the article carefully, and she said, yeah, that was Wilbur. And I said, well, what happened? She said, well, Wilbur went to the government, and the Prime Minister of Canada was involved. The military was, the Defense Department was involved, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which is our federal police force like your FBI, was involved. And Wilbur said, I've got an alien. Name is Alpha. I can get him to land. If you promise you won't shoot him down, I will make arrangements for this alien to land. So they open up the base in Suffield, Alberta. The government, the Prime Minister and his cabinet agree, the RCMP agree, the military agree that they will allow it to land. Then AFA wants an agreement that once they talk to the alien during this landing, that they will allow the thing to take off without any interference. And according to Wilbur Smith's wife, this is 1977, private conversation with me in her house, she said, he went and the RCMP agreed, the military agreed, the Prime Minister went into cabinet, and they couldn't give a 100% guarantee that they would allow it to take off once it had landed. And Wilbur said, okay, that's it, it's called off. We're not, nothing's going to land, game over, and they called it off. So the story is true. They opened the base to land. They knew who was going to land. Wilbur had made the arrangements, and because they wouldn't make the agreement, nothing landed, and so the government covered the story and said, well, therefore UFOs don't exist. And the other thing which I have in the article is this bizarre thing. You have this Eisenhower contact in 54 with the aliens. You have two contacts in Canada. You have this woman in Maine who's saying she's contacting these two satellites. And then you have this bizarre story in England. And this story only came out a couple of years ago by this high-ranking military official who claims, this Horsley guy, his name was Horsley, claims that in 1954, he was basically in charge of the nuclear weapons in the United Kingdom. And he gets contacted by a general, and the general says, we've got an alien that wants to talk to you. And he puts this in his book. He writes this book, his sort of biography, and he puts this story in his book, that he met with an alien in 1954. And that this alien, I think his name was Janice, and it was a bizarre thing. It was an arrangement where he was to meet at this apartment. The general didn't show up, but there was a woman at the apartment. This alien talks to him. He says, this person who looked completely human, which was Wilbur Smith's description of AFA, he said, I could tell who he was on the street. I would be able to see him, but nobody else would. He could fit in. So it's a human-type alien talking to this high-ranking British official who tells the story himself in his book, says that he got the impression from this guy who claimed to be an alien that we're messing around with nuclear weapons, we have to stop it, and that the guy could read his mind, and that he was very upset, that this guy was really getting him very scared, that he could read his mind, and he knew all the nuclear weapons secrets that were in his mind. This guy could read his mind. And he's working for Buckingham Palace. So he goes to Buckingham Palace, he goes to the prince, and he tells the prince the story. And this is Prince Philip, who is into this kind of stuff. And the prince believes it, and they believe that this is a national security problem, so they send him back again to talk to this alien at this apartment, and this high-ranking British official who's told the story publicly says he goes back to the apartment, and when he gets there, the general's gone, the woman who hosted the meeting is gone, all the furniture's gone, the apartment is empty. So in 54, you have these multiple, not one encounter of people talking to aliens. In different countries, you have multiple. And there's the final story is in the United States. In the United States, in November of 1954, there is a Chicago radio station that decides, they know the story about the two satellites, and it's going to play a joke. Okay, let's talk to these aliens and these two satellites. And so the Chicago radio station, which I think is the big Chicago W, whatever it is, the big 50,000-watt station there, they decide they're going to send a message to the aliens. So they only announce this 10 minutes before they're going to do it, so that nobody can get a truck and set up a phony communication or whatever. And 10 minutes at 11:30 at night on their radio show, they make this announcement, come in, aliens, or come in outer space, or something like this, and they do it, and they give 15 seconds of airtime. They break, and they keep the transmitter going, but they basically, the aliens are supposed to break into the communication and give their signal, and in the studio, they say they've got a radio going, and they can hear that nothing's coming across. So they shut down the radio show, they go home, and they miss all the phone calls coming in, and there's 4 phone calls coming in that come in that say that they picked up a message from the aliens. And the CIA actually writes up this story. If you go CIA UFOs, you'll see their 1997 paper that they put out that explained that all UFOs are U-2s, SR-71 spy planes. There's no UFOs. The CIA is not involved. We've never been involved. They tell this story in this paper. And it's a bizarre story that what happened was there was 2 women in northern Chicago, in north end Chicago, who phoned up the radio station and said, what are you doing? This isn't a very funny joke. Why are you playing Jingle Bells and pretending that it's an alien communication? The radio station says, well, we didn't play Jingle Bells. What are you talking about? So they go and they actually get in contact with these women and they listen to this tape. And the tape has this Jingle Bells on there, and it has this sort of like a telex noise going on in the background. So they get the message, they get the tape, they play it on the air a couple of times, and then in 1955, these women go into a prominent outer space journal, publishes their story, and the CIA sees this story about these 2 women who got this message from the 2 satellites. And they decide that they've got to get the tape. And this story is told by the CIA. They tell their bizarre little thing. They will not mention, if you read the CIA version on the CIA website, they do not mention the 2 satellites. They'll say these 2 women got this message, this tape. It wasn't from alien satellites or whatever. And so what they do is the CIA is not involved. They have the Robertson panel. They aren't involved in UFOs. So, of course, what can they do? They can't say, we're CIA guys, we want your tape. And what they do is they dress up 2 guys in Air Force uniforms. And they appear at these 2 women, at these 2 sisters' house to try to get the tape. They won't give them the tape. They said, no, we're not going to give you the tape. And they keep trying. And they finally get a copy of the tape, and then MUFON people find out about this. One of the people in MUFON finds out about, in NICAP. That was a big group at the time. And they decide that they're going to go to the Air Force and find out about this tape. So they contact the Air Force, and you get this whole bizarre thing where the Air Force now has to cover for the CIA. They don't want to say it was the CIA, and they play this little game, and suddenly this researcher from NICAP figures out he's dealing with the CIA, that the CIA recovered this and they impersonated these officers. And if you read the CIA story, it's kind of a long story. It's this bizarre thing where they send Air Force officers, they deny it. The director of the CIA actually writes a letter on this, trying to deny this. And they just keep denying it and denying it. And then finally they say, nobody inside the CIA, we've talked too much to this guy. Every time we say something, we get deeper into the quagmire. Nobody is to talk to this guy, and they just basically ignore the researcher, and the story goes away. And so they sort of kill the story. And the final story that comes before the story dies, and I'm bringing it up now, but the final time it comes up is these two stories, the story that was written in 1955, a year later, and these are the Alsop brothers. And these are two very prominent writers in the United States. At one time, their newspaper column was the most syndicated column in the United States. They're very, very powerful reporters working out of Washington and out of New York. And one of them writes the story about the CIA, or about the picking up the two satellites. And this is almost a year after the story first started to break with Keyhole and with Aviation Week. He writes it, and he talks about how the roof just caves in. And there's two guys. They had a lot of sources inside the NS, the National Security Council. And two of the people on the National Security Council were supposed to appear with one of the brothers at a party. And they find out that these two guys are not allowed to come to the party. And the guy who ultimately, when they disclose the whole story, the guy who says that they can't come to the party is Robert Cutler. And he's the National Security Advisor to President Eisenhower. And so these two guys don't come to the party. And so the Alsop brothers are upset, and they start writing articles about how Cutler was so angry that they had written this article about the two satellites that people at the National Security Council, the National Security Agency, were afraid to be around him. He was absolutely furious. It was brought up in a National Security Council meeting, and they talk about how the White House started to harass them, phone taps, all sorts of harassment stuff on these two major reporters over this thing that they had, what was called top national security material, and that they had put it out, and they were absolutely harassed. And they say directly by the Eisenhower White House over this story of the two satellites. And then eventually, again, it just sort of fades away, and that's the end of the story. Since 1954, nobody's really talked about it. The story just went away, and Rudiak and I knew about the story about the satellites, and Rudiak's put it on his site, now I put it on my site, and it's a story that, like Roswell, was killed and then was brought back up many years later, and when it was brought back up, we found out there was a lot of evidence to back up the fact that this was for real, and all these agencies were closely watching these events in 1954.
Yeah, let's get back to the first hint of this satellite existing, and that was when we mentioned him earlier, Frank Edwards.
Yeah.
He was on the radio from the 1940s to the middle 50s. He's one of the top news commentary people on there. You know, back in those days, Grant, everybody had news and commentary mixed up. They labeled it at the beginning of the show, and they did 15-minute shows, and part of it was news, part of it was commentary, and it was easy really to define which was which sometimes. But anyway, Frank Edwards was one of those top guys. As I said, he's right behind the ratings of Edward R. Murrow, who was a top-rated guy from CBS. But Edwards was quite a guy and well-known. And he became interested in UFOs, I guess, with a friendship with Major Keyhole, among other people. And I don't know, I'm trying to remember exactly when he was on. I know Mutual was famous. I don't even think you're old enough to remember this, but
no.
They had a program on Sundays called The Shadow. And then they had some juvenile strip shows on the weekdays for younger kids. I think Bobby Benson and the B-Bar-B Ranch and some other things. But they weren't really known as, a big news operation. But Frank was there and was listened to by a lot of people and sponsored by the AFL-CIO, among other things. So he was kind of a liberal guy. And finally, they did fire him. Actually, that's kind of a misnomer, too. You know, what happened was the union sponsored that program. Very few programs got on the air if it didn't have a sponsor. And when they stopped sponsoring him because the UFO issue was too hot for them for some reason or another, they Mutual could have continued with it, but they didn't. They had other people in the wings, like over at ABC, they had Paul Harvey beginning to star. It was getting pretty big, and Gabriel Heater was big on Mutual at that time. So there were a lot of reasons for them not to go along with Frank, besides he was verboten. But Edwards, I think in a conversation you and I had, you were telling me that Major Donald Kehoe was a good friend of his, and also I think the Pentagon offered him a job just before he got fired, according to Rich Dolan. Is that right?
He got offered a job, and he turned it down. And the other significant part of it was, well, you know, the head of this big union that sponsored them had 10 million members or whatever, and the guy basically said after he got fired because he was talking too much about UFOs, and the critical thing that I noticed was he was fired on August the 11th, and as I was telling these stories with these two satellites, the one incident that occurred was that Wilbur Smith wanted it to fly over the Canadian capital on August the 1st, and it actually occurred on August the 8th, the Saturday after. Wilbur Smith goes public on the 8th that he's detected a flying saucer over the Canadian capital, this AFA, one of the two satellite guys. And on the 10th, they shut down the Canadian government UFO program, and the very next day, Frank Edwards is fired. So it wanted, I really haven't been able to check that, whether Frank Edwards was published this story or whether he had touched that satellite, Wilbur Smith story, because he was fired the day after the Canadians shut down the Flying Saucer Observatory over this two satellite story.
Yeah, we have a soundbite here of Frank Edwards from 1954. This is at a banquet of some sort. I assume it was in Washington, D.C., but it could have been any place. And he's actually telling tales out of school here. Well, let's listen to it, and you know what we're talking about. He's got the evidence that turned out to be true about these satellites. Listen, folks.
What this booklet does, it discusses a great many of these sightings around Washington, D.C., particularly those of mid-July 1952, when about a dozen of the things came over. About a dozen of them came over one night. They were tracked by radar. They were seen visually. They followed the planes in, and according to the CAA's own booklet, the pilots got good looks at the things as they followed them in and out of the airport. Some of them hovered. Some of them went around the Capitol building. Some went over the monument and the White House and over the deep freeze and circled all around there. They were seen plainly. There's no question about them being there. And as a matter of fact, the officials were so concerned about it that on the following morning they issued a shoot 'em down order. Why didn't they shoot 'em down the first night? They didn't shoot 'em down because the jets couldn't catch them, and they've never been able to catch one yet. The jets couldn't catch them. The next night they showed up. The jets didn't go up after them. They didn't go up with their shoot 'em down order for the simple reason that Albert Einstein and others of comparable standing heard about the shoot 'em down order because the story was on the front pages all over the world. They heard about this shoot 'em down order, and they personally got in touch with the little man in the White House, and I know what Mr. Einstein told him. He said, "Mr. President, anyone who can cross millions of miles of space will be able to take care of himself after he gets there. Don't start something you can't finish." That was one time that Give 'em Hell Harry decided it would be better not to give him any hell.
Okay, Grant, you were telling me he made that speech in Detroit?
Yeah, in Detroit. And you can sort of tell by, you know, the name dropping of Albert Einstein, that the guy did have some inside track sources to high-level people inside the Pentagon, inside the White House. And according to Richard Dolan's book, I mean, his audience was 13 million people, and the population I checked in 1954 was just over 160 million people. So he had a coast-to-coast type audience with half the population. So he's a major player back then, and he did write a number of books on UFOs. If people go to Amazon and stuff, you'll see that he did write a number of books on UFOs.
Yes, he did, and he was not bashful about throwing in UFOs. You have some other sound bites on your website in which he's talking his newscast.
And yet they did state that in 1954, when he was actually fired. I can't remember, there's one article that actually mentions that he only mentioned UFOs, I think, 12 or 13 times in all of 1954, which even gives more importance to the fact that he may have been fired because of this two-satellite story, because he really didn't mention UFOs all that much in 1954. It was only a couple times.
Right. But when he did mention it, it was part of a regular newscast and a regular commentary, and
carried a lot of weight.
And hindsight shows that he was right on. He had the information.
Yeah, he was right on. In fact, you see a lot of this stuff that, a lot of these rumored stories about what Kehoe was putting out and stuff that, it was all denied at the time. But now, looking back, you see that these guys had some pretty good sources, and the majority of the stuff that they were putting out was very, very accurate.
And I would not be surprised if the Pentagon hadn't offered him a job if Dolan wasn't correct on that.
Yeah. And there's another bizarre story that I don't know if you follow the Bob Emenegger thing. He had he was on a radio show, and he talked about Coleman. And I still got to interview Bob about this, because I'm getting into this sort of the communication thing, because I'm doing the Eisenhower thing. How do they make communication? Because, there's four stories of Eisenhower interacting with aliens. And that's way more than any other president. But according to Bob Emenegger, he's very close friends with Bill Coleman, who was the top Air Force guy with Blue Book, the spokesman for the Air Force, had an office in the E-ring of the Pentagon, very high-level Air Force guy. And because in public relations he'd have to know a lot of the stuff and what to say and what not to say, Bob is saying now that Coleman told him that the U.S. Air Force, he didn't say the U.S. Air Force, he didn't define who it was, whether it was the government or the U.S. Air Force, but that they did try to make communication with the aliens, or the UFOs, but they weren't 100% successful. So I wanted to see what that meant, because that was always the thing about, did they really try? It would seem to be totally stupid that you've got these things flying around and that the Air Force wouldn't try to make communication. And it's from a high-level source like Coleman to actually tell Emenegger that they did try to make communication with the UFOs, but it wasn't 100% successful.
Well, you know, even in that soundbite we just played from Detroit, Frank there is mentioning the fact that shoot-down orders are given, and Stanton Friedman has vouched for that several times in a lot of his research, and there's a couple other books out as well that can, shoot to kill orders were given.
Yeah, and then a lot of planes
went down. The thing about all of this, Grant, that amazes me is it looked to me from hindsight now, and I was a young boy at that time and naive and didn't really understand the politics of it at all. But it seems to me that it was on the edge of breaking out, and contact would be public, and something like a UFO landing on the White House lawn might be possible. And then all of a sudden we went into this dark ages, so to speak, where it was all little green men and people were laughing and chuckling. I mean, I'm not quite sure how they pulled that off.
Yeah, it's been pretty effective. I mean, you take a look at the Roswell story, or the number of witnesses that have sort of surfaced now, many years later, and how many there was, to keep all those people quiet and just to keep going, or the satellite story, that they have managed to kill some major stories that, like the satellite story, as I said in the article, you can see a number of times that it almost got out of hand, that they with the CIA, where the CIA really didn't know what to do next, because they were sort of stumbling and making mistakes, and they even admitted in the article that it was one of the reasons why nobody really believed them after that, because they messed this story up so bad, and yet mm-hmm. they managed to keep going and eventually gave up. And but I guess it's a news cycle where, you know, it's like now Kate is pregnant in the UK, that the media goes on to something else, and the only real big stories are where you get a researcher who spends a lot of time, like they did on the Roswell thing with Schmidt and Kerry and Randall and all these people, spent a lot of time, or the Area 51 story, which sort of got out of hand. And there's an article, it's the most read article on my website. There's like 180,000 people have read it, and that's my Area 51 article on my website. And that one, I described the fact that the reason that the Area 51 story got so prominent and such backed up evidence was because George Knapp, who was running the story for the TV station in Las Vegas, was basically given free ride to do this story for 6 or 8 months. And so he spent 6 or 8 months tracking people down. He had Congressman Bill Bray, people working for him. He was beating the bushes. But in the majority of news media outlets, you do the story, and even if it gets a lot of hits or whatever, it's like tomorrow morning you got a deadline, or tomorrow afternoon deadline, 4 o'clock, here's your next story. And so a reporter really doesn't have time to actually go and dig into it and keep going. And right. I think that's basically what happens with UFO stories, is that the reporter, it's not their beat, and they're making a job, they're making a living, and they got to get on to the next story. And it's a three-day news cycle. It's big for the first couple of days. And you can see that on websites, on my website. I'll have a story. Yeah. It's massive the first day. The second day is even more massive. The third day, it's half. By the fifth day or sixth day, the numbers are down to nothing. And that's, yeah. I'm pretty sure, the way it works in news media.
You got a bunch of stuff from Clinton Library. Anything interesting?
Well, as I've always said, I'm not good at websites, so I've got the material that I got from a couple of years ago that I still haven't put up. I've got probably 90% of the material that I got, the files, and I think I've got all the files that I requested now. I still haven't put on my website, because it's like thousands of
pages. Well, you'll keep us surprised that our time is up, unfortunately, for tonight, but... What can we say other than check your website? It's a great website. Give it to everybody.
And I recommend that people go back a few articles. If you go on the front page, just keep going back articles, because there's a lot of good articles, but they're really, you've got to go back maybe 10 or 12 articles back to find them. And because I'm putting them up, and I sort of noticed, like, the ones I think are the most important don't get the hits. Like I did the Obama one, which I thought was like totally stupid, and it got like 10 times the hits of all the ones I thought were important. So keep going back. There's a lot of stuff there I think is important that has never really been made public.
Thanks very much, Grant, for being on, and we'll be talking to you soon again. Thanks for the little story about what's happening there in Washington, D.C. next spring. I think that might be a newsbreaker.
Yeah, I agree.
Thanks
a good
very
night.
Much.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, anytime. This is Jerry Pippin. Feel free to check out our website sometime, won't you? JerryPippin. There's all one word, jerrypippin.com. Thanks for listening. Until then, cheers.